19:3-8. While Moses went up to God, the Lord called him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord.
This morning, the book of Exodus, it begins with three main characters, these three major players. So you have the Israelites who have, they've multiplied in Egypt to the point that their presence scares those in power. And so their hopes and their futures are stripped away as they're enslaved. You have Pharaoh, who is the king of Egypt. He's a man who his power and his authority is matched only by his cruelty and his evil. And then you have this baby born into the scene, Moses. He has all the makings of a hero. Everything's lining up. And then he fails spectacularly, leading to a life lived in obscurity. And each of these three characters, each of these three people, they have a distorted perception of who they are. It's really an identity question. For Pharaoh, he's a man whose power is so absolute, he truly believes he is God, that there's nothing that can challenge his control. Moses finds himself as an old man in the desert, believing that his chances of doing something for his people were lost a long time ago. And the Israelites, they're enslaved, and they're broken. They've lost hope. They've lost sight of who they could be. And what changes everything in the story of Exodus, what challenges their understanding of who they are and what the future holds for them, is that God enters into the story. So this morning we will look at the Israelites, at a suffering people who still hold on to the faint memory of a promise made long ago, at a rescue that calls them to be something new and wonderful, and at the strange but familiar desire to run away from that future and return to the thing that imprisoned them. But first, I'd like to introduce you to someone. So this is Ye, okay? This is in China in July of 2000. I hope I'm pronouncing names right in this story. But Ye is standing here in front of a sculpture. It's called the May 4th Square. And it commemorates a significant moment of protest in China around the end of World War I. Ye was part of a tour group. He was supposed to come with his mother and be here with his mom that day, but she had gotten appendicitis and she had to drop out. So he takes this picture standing there alone in front of this monument. Now fast forward 11 years in Ye's life. In 2011, he will meet the love of his life. Her name was Shui, and they fell in love. They got married. Eventually, they have two twin girls, and they're doing life together. You know, they're raising their children. They're going to work. And one day, they're going through some of Shui's memorabilia. Old photos, that sort of thing. They realize something pretty cool. See, Shui, she had also taken a trip to the May 4th Square when she was younger. And so you can see it's the same place. Not only that, she had gone the same year that Ye did, 2000. But as they looked at her photo, they realized something truly incredible. You see the man behind her on the right in the background? That man is Ye, her husband. And this picture here was happening at the exact same time that that picture was happening. 11 years before they meet, they took a picture a few hundred feet apart. Ye is in Shui's picture, taking his own picture. I mean, it's incredible, right? That's pretty amazing. It gives me goosebumps even now to talk about it. To realize this person who's going to change your life forever, right, you're going to spend your future with, was right there, closer than you ever realized. Ye and Shui, they're not alone either. There's other people who've had the same experience. This is Amy and Nick. They met in college. But here they are 11 years before that in 1994 on the beach, just feet apart, not even knowing the other existed. And in this next picture, proving at Disney World, it really is a small world after all, you have Donna And she realized 30 years later, as she looked at this picture, that the man behind her, pushing the stroller, was her father-in-law. And the boy in that stroller, she would grow up to marry. Now, stories like this, I know, they can be a little too incredible to be coincidence. At least they feel that way, right? And regardless of your own thoughts on romance and soulmates and the one and all that stuff, I think we can understand why someone might look at this and say, wow, do you think maybe they were just meant to be together? I don't know how these stories make you feel. Maybe you want to run home and go through all your pictures together just in case, right? Susanna and I, my wife, we actually realized that, you know, we used to attend the same, like, youth rally growing up. And I'm sure somewhere out there is a picture that has the two of us in it just a few years before we would meet in college. So if anybody out there has any rush photos from Freed Hardeman between 2000 and 2004, let me know. We'd love to look through. But I do find this idea comforting to realize, man, sometimes the people who are most important to you, who will care about you most, who will change your life for the better, they're closer than you think, even when it doesn't feel that way. And I think that's a helpful reminder as we look at the Israelites here in Exodus. Because at the beginning of this story, things are very bad. They're very, very bad for the Israelites, and they feel alone, unheard, and forgotten. They're slaves, overworked, they're brutally beaten. And the words of chapter 1:14, they give us a glimpse, says they made their lives bitter with harsh labor. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. And things only get worse. Pharaoh, he's fearful of the Israelites. And in this horrific and evil act, he orders the death of all their newborn boys. And at first, he has the Hebrew midwives. They're supposed to kill the babies as they're born. And when that doesn't get the job done, Pharaoh enlists the entire country. In 1:22, he says this, "Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." And the Israelites, they've lived in Egypt for hundreds of years. Their home, their neighbors have enslaved them, and they are murdering their children. And it is this horror that God steps into and rescues them from. He raises up a hero to challenge Pharaoh and lead the Israelites. He confronts Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt that the Egyptians worship through these 10 plagues. And then at the crossing of the Red Sea, he puts a final end to Pharaoh's evil. But at the same moment, the exact same moment that God is about to finally put an end to Pharaoh, something interesting is happening inside the hearts of the Israelites. Turn over to chapter 14. Here we find the Israelites, they're pinned down. On one sea, you have the Red Sea. On the other, the Egyptian army. And so start reading with me in verse 10. It says, "As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified." And you can understand why after what they'd experienced. "And they cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, 'Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert.'" And you can hear it, right? What the Israelites are saying. This was a mistake. Maybe is it too late to go back? Now, at this point, we're pretty deep into the Israelites experiencing God's power. We've got a staff that turns into a snake. We have a leprous hand that was healed. We have 10 plagues. That includes, you know, turning the Nile to blood, frogs, gnats, flies, locusts, boils, sickness, darkness, ultimate power over who lives and who dies, one pillar of cloud and one pillar of fire. It's a pretty impressive list. And yet, the Israelites are thinking, We should have stayed. God is in over his head. And now we're all going to die. Now, of course, God is not dismayed by the Egyptians. He parts the waters and saves them. But this is a significant moment because it is the beginning of a pattern. It is a pattern of looking backwards, of longing for the thing that wanted to kill them. And so this pattern begins with slavery was better than death in the desert. And what follows is that at each challenge or difficulty the Israelites face, they're going to look backwards. And I want us to watch this pattern emerge. In chapter 16, the Israelites, they're hungry. They're worried about food. And here's their response to their situation in verse 3. If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There, back in Egypt, we sat around pots of meat. We ate all the food we wanted. But you've brought us out into the desert to starve us to death. So now, not only are they looking back, but the way they think of Egypt is changing too. You know, back at the Red Sea, they talk about, well, you know, in Egypt, we just would have been slaves, right, rather than die. But now, they're not even mentioning the bad conditions of Egypt. Instead, they're reminiscing on how great it was, all the food they could eat. Now we miss Egypt. And it just keeps going. A chapter later, in 17, here the Israelites are thirsty. And hear their complaint in verse 3. The people were thirsty for water there. They grumbled against Moses. And they said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst? And here, and it's kind of hard to wrap my mind around this, but they're zeroing in on this idea that they're accusing God of killing their children. You brought our children out here to die. And you see the irony here? Do you remember what actually happened in Egypt? There was a royal order for all Egyptians to drown Israelite newborn boys. But as Egypt has grown more distant, their perception of their slavery and persecution has grown more distorted. Slavery wasn't so bad. I miss our lives back then. God seems to be the one actually trying to kill us. There's sort of a progression here. It's in the wrong direction. And the problem is it's even worse than it seems because Israel is headed somewhere. They are headed to Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. And at this mountain, they are going to have this intimate encounter with the creator of the universe. And they're going to face there a choice whether to follow him or not. And these two things are converging. As they draw closer physically to Mount Sinai, their perception of the slavery they were rescued from grows more and more warped. It's as if the closer they get to physically meeting with God, the further their hearts wander away from him. And so the question, it kind of hangs over the first half of the book of Exodus is this. Who will they choose to be? The Israelites. Will they embrace the future that God has for them? Or are they stuck forever looking back, longing for the place that would enslave and destroy them? Maybe a good way to put it is this. Will they look back or will they trust forward? I want us to let this question linger for a moment. I want us to think about this. And while we do, I want to consider the story of Kodak, okay? Kodak, maybe you're familiar with Kodak. At one time, Kodak was the king of film, the king of camera film. For some of you, camera film, it's like the way you used to take pictures, right? You took this weird plasticky stuff and you put it in the camera. Now, I'm sure we're familiar with it, but I mean, when was the last time you used camera film? Unless you're like a professional, you probably haven't in a long time. And so you can imagine what killed Kodak, right? What was it? Yeah, cell phones and digital cameras. Absolutely. Here is the crazy thing, all right? That digital cameras coming along and cell phone cameras almost killed Kodak. And the crazy thing is they invented the digital camera. There was this guy named Steven Sasson. He was an engineer for Kodak. And way back in 1975, he developed a digital camera. And he took it to the higher-ups. He thought they'd be pumped. He thought they'd be excited. And they said, no. Because they felt like their main business came from making film that had to be constantly replaced And what you're proposing would negate the need for all this film. So instead, they tucked this technology away. They suppressed it. They hid it. Well, the problem, of course, eventually someone else brought digital cameras into the mainstream, and it nearly bankrupted Kodak. They could have been the ones to pioneer digital photography, but in 1975, the future of digital cameras was uncertain. It was a total unknown, and it was easier to look back. They knew camera film worked, and because of that, they nearly lost everything. Here's the story of Netflix and Blockbuster. You probably know where this is going. You know Netflix. Some people may not know Blockbuster. You know, I found it's actually really funny. I have a six-year-old son, and when you start trying to explain something like this, you realize it kind of sounds absurd today. You know, it's like, well, okay, so if you wanted to watch a movie back in the day, instead of just picking the movie from your TV, you would drive to this place. You had almost like a library card you would scan in to make sure like you didn't have any other of their movies out. And you would go, and you couldn't just pick the movie you wanted. You had to go see what movies they had. If they didn't have the movie that you wanted, you would just pick a different movie. I guess we're not seeing that tonight. And then you would take it home, and then you would take it back and trade it back in. It's kind of weird to think about today. Now, in 2000... Netflix was a new company, and they just mailed DVDs to people. They weren't even streaming yet. They would mail you a DVD of your choice that you could pick from their website. And they were struggling. They needed cash to keep this whole thing going. And so they offered to sell their business to Blockbuster, who had all these brick-and-mortar stores where you could rent movies from. They offered to sell Netflix to Blockbuster for $50 million. And they were laughed out of the building, right? No way. And you can probably guess how this story ends. Netflix today is worth over $170 billion. And when's the last time you saw a Blockbuster, right? You know, maybe if they had looked to the future and who they could have been rather than being stuck looking backwards at who they had been, maybe Blockbuster would be around today streaming you the new live-action Avatar series. So let's return to our question, who will the Israelites be? Will they look back or trust forward? They approach the mountain of God, their hearts still thinking about Egypt. And as they draw near, God speaks. And you get the sense that God is very aware of what's going on in their hearts. Listen to what he says in chapter 19, verse 4. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. So now, if you obey me fully, keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Can you hear it in his words? He says, you saw it yourself, Israel. You were there. You watched what happened in Egypt. I rescued you. You know it's true. And I have something incredible and wonderful and new for you. But you have to choose it. You can't keep looking back. Who will they be? Verse 8 says, the people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has said. Yes! Right? They did it. They chose this beautiful future that God has in store for them. No longer will they be slaves. They are choosing to be this holy people, a kingdom of priests who will represent God to the entire world. They have broken the pattern. They're not looking back any longer. And so Moses, he goes up onto the mountain, which at this point it's covered in smoke. There's thunder and lightning. God's presence is just feet away. It is terrifying and awe-inspiring. And while he's up there, God is giving them the Ten Commandments. He's showing them how to do this new thing, to live into this new identity as a holy nation. And he gives them laws and structures so they can treat each other with compassion. And God is writing it into stone with his own finger. And meanwhile, back at the foot of the mountain, the Israelites are... Oh, right. That's what the Israelites are doing. The pattern wasn't broken. Moses is gone longer than they like. And their hearts, they go back to Egypt. Egypt, where several different groups worshiped gods who were portrayed as these calf idols. And they think, you know, that was pretty nice. And at the exact same time that God is writing, do not make an idol for yourself, they are bowing down before this golden statue of a cow. It is as bad as it can be. I've heard it likened to a newlywed who immediately after reciting their vows has an affair at the reception. And honestly, what's even sadder is this just sets the scene for the rest of the Old Testament. Over and over, they return to idolatry and greed, mistreatment of the marginalized, every other form of sin's slavery. It is a trust issue at its heart, really. They refuse to trust that what God has for them is better than what they had back in Egypt. And so they return time and time again to slavery. And reading this, it sort of makes you angry as the Israelites. You know, what are they doing? How can they keep making the same mistake again and again? Why do they want to go back to the thing that will ruin them? I just don't understand. But the thing is, we do understand, right? Because we live out the same pattern. We're freed from sin slavery by Jesus. But we return to it again and again. In the same way, at its heart, it's a trust issue. You know, we don't trust that God will provide for us. So we lie or deceive or cheat. We lash out in anger to get our way. Because we can look back, we see that works. We don't believe that God will be with us, that he'll provide us a place and a people like he's promised. So we use our words to manipulate others. We make fun of the right people. We exclude them because it makes the rest of us feel like we belong. And we're scared that if we don't, otherwise God might leave us alone. We don't trust that God will fulfill us, so we set out to indulge our desires, regardless of how harmful it is to ourselves or in what context God says it's right to do so, or how denigrating and dehumanizing it is to others, because we just don't trust that God really will be enough. And the Israelites, we see ourselves, our propensity to chase after things that have enslaved us and abused us and seek to kill us. Egypt looks different today, but we seem to return to it just as often as the Israelites. And we ultimately are confronted with the same question they were. Who will we be, looking back or trusting forward? You remember our friend in China, Ye. So he, remember his story, he got married in 2011. But he had actually been at the exact same place as his wife, both taking a picture back in the year 2000. And I have spent some time wondering what those years between were like for him. You know, many of us know very well that deep human longing to find a person you love and who loves you back in a way that you commit to love each other for the rest of your lives in marriage. And, you know, I feel a little embarrassed to talk about it, but I remember back when I was single one time going to Disney World with my family. And we were walking around at night, and, you know, Disney World, it's all lit up. And it did feel kind of magical, kind of romantic. And I remember this thought, this feeling I had, it made me think, I don't want to be here single at this special place. I want to be here with my wife, with the person who I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. And I can imagine that between 2000 and 2011, Ye, as he looked back on this picture at a famous monument, or there are tourists everywhere, there are couples and families taking pictures together, that as he looked back at this, it made him feel sad and lonely. But what if Ye had had the other picture? Because I guarantee when he sees this photo now, it does not make him sad, right? It makes him more certain than ever. Ye just needed a bigger perspective. He needed a fuller picture. You know, this morning I have framed this choice that the Israelites had to make as a choice between looking back or trusting forward. But really, this is a false choice. The problem is not looking back. It's what are you looking back at, right? It's having the right perspective, seeing the bigger picture. Now, sure, we see times when the Israelites look back to Egypt and they think about, wow, slavery sure beats dying in the desert. Or, you know what I really miss? All that meat we sat around eating between our children being drowned. But that's not all there was to see back in Egypt. Because just like Shwe is just out of frame of Ye's picture, but still very present, God was with the Israelites all along. All along. And all they had to do was shift their perspective to see it. Even back at the very beginning of Exodus, God is at work. In chapter 1, if you go back and read, as the oppression increases and Pharaoh tries to force the Hebrew midwives to kill the male babies as they're born, the Israelites continue to increase in spite of it. And I'm just going to read verses 20 through 21 of chapter 1. It says, so God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Even before the burning bush, even before Moses is born, God is already at work. He's there in the story. And of course, then he is the one who raises up Moses. And he's the one who confronts Pharaoh. And the miracles and the providence and God's faithfulness are all things the Israelites could look back on and see. The question is not, will you look back or will you trust forward? The question is, will you look back and see God at work and trust him going forward? And God knows us and our hearts so well. He knows we're tempted. He knows we'll look back to Egypt and say, you know, I kind of miss slavery. And so he gives the Israelites the Passover. You know, he says to Israel, I know you'll forget and misremember and you'll look back on the wrong things. So I'll help you. Every year, you'll eat this meal. You'll relive this moment, the moment when God spares them and rescues them out of slavery. He is helping them to look back with the right perspective, to see how he's been with them so they can trust him going forward. And we can look back as well. We can see where God has been active in our lives, and it helps us to trust him going forward. I found a couple of things that have really helped me with my perspective when I look back. I'll just share them real quickly. And one is this. It's the body of Christ. It's the church. I think the reality is our perspective on God is often weakest when we are hurting. We feel alone and forgotten, so we have a hard time seeing him. And that's when we need others who can help us see. That's why we need to be here, why the church comes together. That's also why being here, you know, means more than sitting in this room on Sunday, right? It means committing to this community, to deepening relationships. Listen, there are children upstairs right now, and they need you to share your stories and broaden their perspective of who God is. And there are youth and college students and young adults, not so young adults, and whatever comes after that, who need you, and you need them too. And when we're giving our lives to one another, when we're sharing our time and our stories, our tears and our joys, our perspectives grow fuller. We see God more clearly. The other thing that's helped me with my perspective is just time. You know, the longer I've lived, the more I can look back and see how God has worked in my life. Now, you know that because of Jesus, we're going to live forever. Right? And man, it is a beautiful picture to imagine how, as our lives stretch out into eternity with him, we'll see more and more of how he was always there every step of the way, until every moment of our timeline is full with the beauty and glory of God. Now, it is possible this morning, as we've talked about how we return to sin again and again, that you have felt convicted. And conviction is a good thing. It leads to repentance. But what I don't want any of us to leave here is with a feeling of defeat, you know, because I've messed up so many times and I keep messing up. Listen, the Israelites don't ever figure it out, okay? In the Old Testament, it's the same old story. It's not a story of them finally getting it together. It is a story of God's continual mercy and grace. God sticks with them, and he's sticking with you. And just like the Israelites could look back to the Passover and Exodus as this reminder they can always trust God, we can always look back to the cross. We see our God dying there for us. There's no sin in your life beyond his grace. And the cross is the ultimate reminder that we can trust him going forward. Now, as we close out, I'm going to show you a picture of myself at Disney World. And as I do so, I want you to look very carefully in the background, because that exact same day, my future wife, Susanna, happened... No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. That would have been amazing, though, right? Like, that would have been wild. Oh. No, look, that just doesn't happen to be our story, right? But I do know this about my story and her story and your story as well, is that God has been there every step of the way. He's in every photo. He's in every frame. He's been there with you. And we don't always have the perspective to see exactly what he's up to, but there's no question that he is there. And there's no better choice than to put your trust in him. So if our church family can help you this morning by praying for you or listening to what's happening in your life, or, man, we can add another baptism this morning. We can make that happen right now. This is a time where you can come forward and let us know or speak to someone afterwards. Let's stand together and let's praise our God.
Strength will rise as we wait upon the Lord. Wait upon the Lord. We will wait upon the Lord.